in the limelight.
Venus is nearly a twin for Earth in size and 30% closer to the Sun. Because it is so much closer, it is much warmer. But if solar distance were the sole consideration, the planet's temperature would be expected to average about 60 degrees Celsius, with more clement climates near the poles. Thus, through the 1950s, many writers envisioned Venus as a world of steaming jungles, perhaps abounding with creatures comparable to the giant amphibians and reptiles that adorned Earth during its warmer prehistoric past. However, this glorious picture was ruined forever when NASA's Mariner 2 probe flew by Venus in 1962 and took measurements showing the planet's surface temperature to be about 450 degrees Celsius, hot enough to melt lead. Apparently, Venus's thick carbon dioxide atmosphere was doing much more than hiding the planet's surface from our view. It was creating a huge greenhouse effect, trapping heat beneath its blanket of clouds, with the result being a planet far too hot for life. We now present you an article written by Robert Zubrin, an aerospace engineer who's the founder of the Mars Society and the president of Pioneer Astronautics, under the heading, Might We Find Life on Venus? The article was published in a National Review website. Please stay with us for more of Robert Zubrin's article. On 17th of September, a group of scientists using Earth-based telescopes announced that they had detected phosphine in the atmosphere of Venus. On Earth, phosphine is almost always produced by microbial activity. Whilst geological processes are known that can, in principle, produce phosphine, the concentrations of the gas found on Venus, while small, were nevertheless much too high to be attributable to such sources. So how could the phosphine have gotten there? The simplest explanation is life. But how is that possible? Venus is nearly a twin for Earth in size and 30% closer to the Sun. Because it is so much closer, it is much warmer. But if solar distance were the sole consideration, the planet's temperature would be expected to average about 60 degrees Celsius, with more clement climates near the poles of Venus. Thus, throughout the 1950s, many writers envisioned Venus as a world of steaming jungles, perhaps abounding with creatures comparable to the giant amphibians and reptiles that adorned Earth during its warmer prehistoric past. However, this glorious picture was ruined forever when NASA's Mariner 2 probe flew by Venus in 1962 and took measurements showing the planet's surface temperature to be about 450 degrees Celsius. Hot enough to melt lead. Apparently, Venus's thick carbon dioxide atmosphere was doing much more than hide the planet's surface from our view. It was creating a giant greenhouse effect, trapping heat beneath its blanket of clouds, with the result being a planet far too hot for life. However, some scientists did not give up hope. Whilst the Mariner 2 findings spelled curtains for Venusian dinosaurs, perhaps other types of life might still have a chance. In 1967, Carl Sagan initiated such speculation by pointing out that whilst Venus's surface temperature would be instantly fatal to any known form of terrestrial life, the atmosphere becomes progressively cooler with altitude. Indeed, at 55 kilometers, where the atmospheric pressure has fallen from the surface's 90 bar, a bar is the average atmospheric pressure on Earth, to about half a bar, the same as Earth in the high Andes, the temperature is a pleasant 30 degrees Celsius. Anyone can live there, all they need to do is float. Earth's atmosphere is thick with floating microbes. Couldn't the same be true on Venus? Not so fast though, it was answered. Whilst it is true that plenty of very viable microbes can be found floating about in Earth's atmosphere and even in the high stratosphere under nearly space-like conditions, they don't actually live there. All microbial metabolism takes place on or below the Earth's surface. Terrestrial microbes in flight are in suspended animation, just traveling around whilst taking a break from life. This is a tough argument to refute, but nevertheless speculation continued, with possible answers being offered by a number of researchers, including notably American planetary scientist David Greenspoon in 1997, and British astrobiologist Charles Cockerill in 1999, and an international team in 2017. But until the phosphine discovery this week, there were no data supporting any such hypotheses. So what do we do now? The first thing that needs to be done is to confirm the phosphine detection in Venus's atmosphere. The means for this are readily at hand. The European Space Agency's BepiColombo probe, now on its way to Mercury, will swing by Venus on 15th of October, coming within 10,000 kilometers of the planet, and pass by again next August 10th at a mere 550 kilometers altitude. It should be able to take the needed measurements. Teams of astronomers with other Earth-based telescopes will no doubt be quickly on the case as well. So in all probability, we will have confirmation or refutation. I bet on confirmation. The phosphine discovery team included some real heavy hitters within a year. But what's next? NASA has two proposals for Venus missions under current consideration, one of which, the Da Vinci Plus mission led by planetary scientist James Garvin, would parachute a probe into Venus's atmosphere in around 2026, taking measurements during a leisurely several-hour float downward before it expires from heat on the surface of the planet. The entrepreneurial Rocket Lab company also plans a parachute probe mission to Venus, possibly as early as 2023. We could learn a lot from such missions, but I think we can do much better. The right way to explore Venus is by balloon. Venus's thick carbon dioxide atmosphere makes ballooning easy. In fact, in the 1980s, the Soviets flew two Vega balloons, taking data over wide stretches of the planet for about 50 hours. The Vega balloons were filled with helium and floated level at about 55 kilometers altitude. However, my preferred approach would be the solar Montgolfier balloon, technology demonstrated by NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory's JPL's Jack Jones in the 1990s. A solar Montgolfier balloon is just a black balloon with an open bottom and a vent valve on top. It can be deployed from the air or from an entry capsule like a parachute, instantly inflating with air upon release. Absorbing sunlight, the balloon's black skin then heats up the air inside, providing float gas. Then, if you want to go up, keep the vent valve closed. If you want to go down, open the valve a bit and vent some hot gas out of the top, replacing it with cold air from the bottom. These systems are quite controllable. In fact, in 2004, my own company, Pioneer Astronautics, demonstrated the balloon's ability to be used as soft landers, employing one to set down a payload on the Colorado Parade with an impact velocity of just 5 miles per hour, and then take off again. Similar maneuvers could be done in Venus's atmosphere. To explore Venus using such technology, we might send an orbiter carrying several balloon probes, each in its own entry capsule. The orbiter could drop off these capsules one by one or all at once and serve as their data relay satellite. Entering the atmosphere, the capsule would use its heat shield to absorb the re-entry heating and then employ atmospheric drag to slow down to subsonic speeds. The back shell of the capsule would then be blown off and the solar balloon, mortared out to be inflated like a parachute, pulling the gondola out of the capsule, which would then drop away. With its black skin heated by solar radiation, the balloon would rapidly heat up the air inside and begin to float. Carrying a gondola equipped with scientific instruments, a set of solar panels, a container of water for thermal control, and a UHF radio system for communications with the orbiter. Then the fun begins. Venus's atmosphere offers temperatures ranging from 460 degrees Celsius to minus 70 degrees Celsius, depending on the altitude. It's not clear when in this continuum might be the best place to look for signs of life, so we need to explore as much of it as possible. With a solar balloon, we can. So let's say we start floating at 60 kilometers, where the ambient temperature is minus 10 degrees Celsius. We can use the environment to freeze our water into ice. Then we open our vent valve, and drop down into the hot lower regions, taking data as we go, using our ice as coolant. Conceivably, we could make it all the way to the surface. Soviet landers survived there for as long as 20 minutes. For some quick sampling, and then take off to return to safety in the colder air aloft. In the course of sounding the atmosphere in this way, we would get a map of wind speeds and direction at various altitudes. Knowing this, we could navigate the planet by choosing our altitude to provide the breeze that would take us where we wish. Adopting such a strategy, we could execute repeated ascents and descents, exploring the atmosphere at all altitudes and latitudes, searching for underground caverns with ground-penetrating radar, imaging the ground from low altitude and possibly even sampling the surface at numerous locations separated by continental distances. If Venus has life, we'd have a fair shot at finding it. But will we find life in Venus? That's anyone's guess. We have biomarkers showing that there was life on Earth 3.8 billion years ago, almost immediately after the end of the primeval heavy meteor bombardment. The fact that life appeared on Earth virtually as soon as it could implies one of two possibilities. Either the processes that drive chemicals to complexify themselves into life are highly probable, or spores of microbial life are floating around in space, ready to land, multiply and evolve as soon as a planet becomes habitable. In either case, it means that life is plentiful in the universe. Early Venus was not as hot as it is today, as the Sun was only 70% as strong at that time, and the processes that created Venus's terrifically effective greenhouse effect had not yet occurred. In fact, early Venus was similar enough to early Earth that it's an excellent bet that through either parallel native evolution or microbial immigration, Venus was a home for life at one time. But while Earth-type carbon and water-based life forms may well have once thrived on Venus, they certainly would have arrived there if from no other source than microbe-rich meteors knocked off of Earth. It's hard to see how any known terrestrial life could survive on Venus today, but that does not mean that there is no life there. There is an interdisciplinary branch of science known as complexity theory that holds that nature tends to organize itself at all levels into autocatalyzed self-replicating systems. That is, if A promotes the creation of B and B promotes the creation of A, then the two will form a system that organizes surrounding resources to serve its multiplication. This character defines many systems ranging from the biosphere to the economy. For example, think of the Industrial Revolution. Coal mining promotes steel production, which enables steam engines, which promote coal mining, forming an autocatalytic system that grows exponentially, drawing the labor, capital, and other material resources of the prior economy into its vortex. Venus's current conditions are radically different from those of Earth, but it certainly offers a grand theater for chemistry to find alternative paths to self-organization. Perhaps it did. Perhaps life as we know it on Earth is just one specific example drawn from a much vaster set of possibilities. There could be, to paraphrase William Shakespeare, much stranger things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in our philosophy. There is only one way to find out.